What I'm going to do today is you're not going to see any simulation, even though that tends to be a lot of what I do. Instead, what I wanted to do in this first lecture is introduce you to the area of free boundary problems in fluid mechanics. It's a very rich and a very diverse scientific area in fluid mechanics. It has lots of beautiful phenomena. And so what I wanted to do this first lecture was to go through various areas that have been of particular interest to me and really talk about the science and the fluid mechanics and some of the experimental things that go on there. And then in the next four lectures, move into how you model these types of free boundary problems, how you compute them, things like that. And along the way, I'll point out in this first lecture those areas that I'll talk about more specifically in the next four. All right. So that's me. All right. So start right at the beginning. So what is a free boundary problem in fluid dynamics? Well, I should get out my pointer. So there I kind of give what I consider the kernel of it. And so a free boundary problem is when the boundary of a fluid, a boundary, say, that separates two fluids. So in the first case, say, it would be the boundary of a bubble or of a water droplet. In the second case, say, it would be a dividing surface that separates two immiscible fluids that are flowing past each other. Or a boundary within a fluid, and by that I mean maybe I have some sort of object, a deformable object, that's moving around and interacting with the fluid. An example might be an insect or an insect's wing, or it might be a flag, something like this. So a boundary within a fluid, and it's a free boundary problem when the dynamics of the fluid and of the surface have to be determined simultaneously in order to solve the problem at hand. All right? And so when you have something like a bubble that's rising through a fluid, then that bubble is exerting, or the boundary of the bubble is exerting forces on the fluid through its surface tension, for example. And it's also feeling forces that the fluid is exerting upon it, say through the fluid's inertia or through its viscosity, its viscous effect, things like that. So there are problems in which the dynamics of the fluid and the boundary are very intimately and tightly coupled. Those are free boundary problems in fluid mechanics. So let me show particular and particularly beautiful free boundary problem. This is from a friend of mine who has a fluid mechanics lab at MIT named John Bush. I hope you can see this well. Let me turn it this way first. So these are what are called water chains. Now the first thing I want to tell you is that you have a pipe, and actually I think he's flowing some sort of rather viscous fluid. It's more viscous than water. Through this pipe, and it's hitting a plate. So there's a very small gap. The pipe ends right above this plate, and the fluid shoots out the sides. All right? Now, so you end up getting a sheet, kind of almost a radially symmetric sheet that is coming out from this little gap, and this breaks up so that it shoots out, actually right here at the edge. What happens is that jets of fluid are forming along the boundary of this surface of fluid. They're colliding with each other, splitting into another direction with two jets, colliding again and then splitting again and kind of intertwining through each other like a chain, like a linked chain. Now, this is a free boundary problem, all right? So the surface tension of the fluid, which is exerting forces on the liquid, on the water or whatever that is there, is very important, for example, in determining the length scale of this kind of instability that you see along the edge. The inertia of the fluid itself as it's shooting out from the side is very important in determining the length scale at which this starts to break up. So that's a free boundary problem. It's a beautiful free boundary problem. No one can really compute something like this as yet. That's well beyond the current state of affairs. Yeah, that's right. You don't need to compute it. That's right. And so what John has done, too, is that he's abstracted out what he thinks is the relevant fluid dynamics that's going on in one of these little water chains here, shooting out from the sides. This bigger structure is related to something called a water bell. A water bell is in a slightly different parameter regime than this, where actually this surface folds all the way around and encloses upon itself. So you end up having a closed bubble of air inside of running fluid. And when you turn up the flow velocity, then that will start to break up and form these beautiful patterns. So here he's kind of abstracted out in a separate experiment what he thinks is going on inside of one of these water chains. And he found if you looked at it very closely with high-speed photography, you would see actually that this thing was actually breaking itself up at some point and forming what he called a fishbone pattern. So what's nice about this, again, surface forces are very important in deciding the length scale at which these droplets are shooting out. There's singularity formation going on in this problem. That's always a very interesting aspect of free surface flows, is that topology changes are happening all the time in this particular case. In the continuum understanding of fluid mechanics, that change in topology where this detaches itself from the bulk of the fluid is a singularity in the partial differential equations that govern the fluid. And so that's been an area of intense research, and I'll talk a bit about some of my own work in that tomorrow, in trying to understand singularities in free surface flows. John Bush, by the way, is a Canadian. And he gives a very nice talk. All right. So now I want to start talking about what are some of the mathematical aspects of fluid mechanics as is relevant to free surface flows. And this and a couple of other slides are about as far as all the... Of course, this is quite a descent if you haven't seen the Navier-Stokes equations before, but this is about as far as I'll descend at the moment into the mathematics of fluid flows, is introducing what should be the relevant equations. And so in these types of problems, what we're dealing with is a region, I'll call it big omega of T, in which I have a fluid. I'm describing a fluid motion within this region. And this region is bounded by some boundary called gamma of T, which is the fluid's dynamic boundary. All right, so I want to determine the motion of gamma of T and the dynamics of the fluid within the boundary. Now, fluid mechanics, or the equations of fluid mechanics, typically concern themselves with the evolution of the velocity of the fluid. And so here I have a point X. This could be an R2 or R3, a two- or three-dimensional description. And at a point X, I have a vector, which is the two- or three-dimensional velocity of the fluid at that point. Now, that velocity is, in the most common description, which is actually quite accurate for example, the flow of water or glycerin, so-called Newtonian fluids, kind of the standard fluids that we deal with every day, that's well described by a set of equations called the Navier-Stokes equations. And the Navier-Stokes equations are a version of Newton's second law, so momentum balance, for a continuously deformable medium. So this is really just F equals ma. And so I'll just read it to you. This is the fluid density, rho. This object here, this partial derivative of the velocity with respect to time, plus this quadratic nonlinear term, is really just a time derivative in a frame that's moving with the fluid. That's one way of interpreting it. So this is really just some sort of fancy time derivative. So it's the density times the acceleration is balanced by forces that are acting within the fluid. And the two most relevant for what I'll be talking about most of the time is the pressure. Okay, so I have the gradient of the pressure sitting on the right-hand side, and the so-called viscous forces, or the forces for the dissipation of momentum in the fluid. And so U is a function of x and t, space and time. The pressure is a function of x and t, space and time. And I'm just going to take the case which is the easiest for all of my lectures, where rho is just going to be a constant. So I have a glass of water. The density changes very little across the water. And the viscosity, or the the stickiness of the fluid, if you like, the difficulty with which you can shear it that measures, that quantifies that property. The shear viscosity, I'll assume, is also just a material property which is constant in the fluid. Okay, so as I said, this is really just a fancy version of F equals ma. Now, so what I've shown you is I have this dynamics equation for the velocity, and I have a pressure in it. So I have two field variables, the velocity and the pressure, but only an evolution equation for the velocity itself. So what about the pressure? The pressure is a very odd quantity in most kind of terrestrial fluid mechanics problems. And that's because in kind of our everyday life, we really deal with fluids that are virtually incompressible. Okay? So when you move them around and you look at the evolution of little volumes of fluid, they don't change their volume as they flow. And that condition, it's an expression of conservation of mass for an incompressible fluid, is that the divergence of the velocity field is zero everywhere in the fluid. So I have a global constraint, actually, and this is an important part of fluid mechanics in that I have to satisfy a global constraint everywhere in the fluid, and this is an auxiliary condition that will indirectly determine what this pressure gradient is. So the Navier-Stokes equations, and I should put them back up instead of hiding them from you. I have a velocity for the evolution, or rather an equation for the evolution of the velocity, the Navier-Stokes equations. It contains the pressure, and I have another constraint equation on the velocity, and that's another condition that will determine the pressure. The pressure acts, if you like, as a Lagrange multiplier in the dynamics that keeps an incompressibility constraint satisfied in time. So that's, in free surface flows, that is a very much of a complicating factor in the way you have to approach all of these problems numerically and analytically. All right? Any questions? Now, you also need for these problems is you need to know about boundary conditions, and this is the other kind of rat's nest that you have to get into in trying to understand free boundary problems. So, now, what I'm going to set up here is I'm going to think about having a boundary between two fluids. On the previous slide, I just showed you a fluid domain, and I want to see how that domain changes, or equivalently, how the boundary of that domain evolves. But now I'm going to just imagine I have a dividing interface or a free surface that sits between two fluids. All right, just a slight generalization. And so let's call those two regions omega 1, omega 2. Call it gamma, the surface itself. And I endow it with a normal. And it's going to have some sort of velocity. That's what I want to find. I want to find the velocity of this boundary. Let's call that V. And more than that, it might exert a surface stress. So this might be a surface that has a surface tension, so something that's drawing it taut. And that's a stress that's being exerted by the surface onto the fluid. Okay? Or it might be this rod, this flexible rod, flying through the air, and that exerts stresses on the fluid, if I wanted to think of this as a free boundary, if I just threw it through the air. So it exerts some sort of surface stress. So that's a force per unit area. So now, what I've done is I'm just rewriting the Navier-Stokes equations in a slightly different way. So I write rho du dt. This is that fancy time derivative. I've just used this capital D to stand for that quantity here. Keep forgetting I have two slides up. And I'm going to write the right-hand side, that pressure gradient plus the viscous term, as the divergence of some sort of matrix or rank 2 tensor. And so this is what's called the stress tensor. That's the object that tells you how the fluid exerts stress on itself across a boundary. All right, so this is something that in which the internal stresses of the fluid are recorded or captured. And so the typical boundary conditions are, first, they're both quite reasonable. One is that the velocity of this boundary has to be the same as the velocity of the fluid on either side of it. They move together. The fluid sticks to it. Okay? So if I have my glass of water, then If I move this through it, then the fluid is sticking to my pointer and being dragged around by it. That's really what this condition is. The free boundary moves at the same velocity as the fluid on either side, the fluid velocity. And the last says that the jump in stressors across a boundary is balanced by the stress that the surface exerts on the fluids. And that's the last condition. Okay, so that actually closes the equations, except I haven't told you what this is. And that's where a lot of interesting physics comes in. What is this stress that gets exerted on the fluids by the boundary? So, for example, if you have a surface tension, that's a particular case of a stress that you'll pose, a surface tension, something that's proportional to the curvature of the boundary. Or if my free boundary were, for example, this rod, this flexible rod, then the stress might also come from the inertial forces of this rod as it moves through the fluid. So that's where lots of interesting things come in and lots of complications. All right. Now, let me show you another case of a free boundary problem. And this is a very famous one. This is one upon which I've done a lot of work myself. And this says, this problem just concerns a very simple experimental device called a Healy-Shaw cell. So just stare at this and I'll tell you what it is. A Healy-Shaw cell is just just take two glass plates, stack them parallel to each other, put some spacers in between them so they're parallel to each other with a very thin gap between them, and fill it with a fluid. In this case, fill it with glycerin, which is a little bit more viscous than water. Drill a hole in the top plate and start to pump air in to that hole. And so you get a bubble that starts to expand in this very thin gap. This is what happens to that bubble as it expands. It doesn't remain circular. The circular case is an allowable solution, just an expanding circular bubble. But it turns out that if your pumping rate or your mass flux into the bubble is high enough, that is not stable. And it becomes unstable to something called the Safman-Taylor instability. Now, and you get these beautifully what you call ramified patterns. And so this line that you're seeing here is just the interface between the glycerin and the air. And this is expanding out. This is just a snapshot at it at some time as it's developed. Now, what's very interesting about this problem is that you see patterns of this sort in many problems outside of fluid mechanics, in many problems in material science, for example. The Safman-Taylor instability is very analogous to fundamental instabilities in solidification problems. And you see patterns like this arise, for example, in certain cases of bacterial growth, growth of bacterial colonies. And so and I'll tell you what the mathematical description of this is, but it's a prototype of a whole class of pattern-forming systems in soft condensed matter. All right, so it's something that's really worth your time to figure out how to compute these things well, how to study them statistically. And that's another area in which there's been a lot of work in the past 15 or 20 years, actually. All right, so, and it turns out that when you start to look at this problem numerically, it becomes a very nice test problem for building numerical methods that you find that you can apply to many other free boundary problems in fluid mechanics, which is another reason for looking at it for someone like me, aside from my interest in the physics of the problem. So let me just tell you how that's described, because it has an apparent property which it shares with the more complicated Navier-Stokes equations. And so, as I said, these are so-called Healy-Shaw flows, and they're the flows of liquids in very thin gaps. For example, they also arise in display device design, okay, where you have materials in very thin gaps. And so here we are. I have these two plates. They're spaced by some thickness B. Say my device has a lateral extent L, and I'm going to assume that B over L is a small parameter. So it's a large aspect ratio device. There's a velocity u in the fluid. Here's the liquid, and here's the gas. There. And it turns out that you can use this small parameter, the aspect ratio of the system, to systematically expand the Navier-Stokes equations and to find a reduced form for the Navier-Stokes equations and to yield something that's called Darcy's law. And Darcy's law says that the velocity is proportional just to the pressure gradient. All right? All the nonlinearities in the Navier-Stokes equations is u dot grad u. They are all smaller order in this small epsilon expansion. And this term actually arose from an expansion of the viscous term, the term that had the Laplacian sitting on it. You can imagine that taking a couple of transverse derivatives of u might produce some big terms. And this velocity, well, I've drawn here just a, you imagine, well, it's really a thin gap, so it's a three-dimensional velocity in there. But this is the averaged velocity across the gap thickness, which is a two-dimensional object. And there's a scaling factor which involves the shear viscosity of the fluid and the thickness. I've written it in dimensional form. Now, the condition that survives intact is this divergence-free condition. That didn't change. All right? And so you still have a divergence-free condition. What this reveals for you is the nature of this divergence-free condition, because if I take now just a divergence of Darcy's law there, I see immediately that the pressure has to be a harmonic function. All right? So it tells me that my dynamics has an elliptic problem at its core. It has a boundary value problem at its core. And this starts to tell you what some of the difficulties are now in computing these problems, because in this external domain, omega, it's very complicated. It's a very ramified, complicated, time-dependent domain. And I'm having to solve, apparently, a boundary value problem in this complicated domain. Now, just think about how you might do that numerically. All right? I'm going to have to specify some boundary conditions, obviously, along the surface, some boundary conditions at infinity. But then somehow I'm going to have to discretize this domain or do something and find out what the pressure is so that I can solve the dynamical problem. That turns out to be the easy problem, surprisingly enough. Yes, it does. Yeah, that's right. And so really, you would assume the air pressure is constant, but the pumping gives you a flux condition at infinity, the rate at which you're drawing fluid out at infinity, and that gives you a boundary condition on the pressure. So I think those two cases start to tell you about what it is that makes these problems difficult and also very interesting. So first of all, it could be in the case of, the flow inside of my time-dependent domain is itself non-local because I have to satisfy this global condition. This divergence of u is equal to zero. And that gives that generates elliptic equations that the pressure must satisfy in either the Navier-Stokes case or in this Darcy's law case. So I have to solve elliptic problems in very complicated domains, geometrically complicated domains. As I said, this flow domain is time-dependent, and it can become very ramified, and it can even become singular in the sense that the boundary, for example, can become singular. The flow quantities can become singular. If you go and look back at this particular case of my acquaintance John Bush's, the fluid domain is fissioning itself all the time. It's full of singularities. You see that kind of problem also in these Healy-Shaw flows. So you have to think about whether you're going to pay attention to those things, you're going to try to understand them, you're going to figure out how to compute through them. There's all sorts of decisions one might have to make. And then the other real difficulty is that these surface stresses, which I haven't specified for you, but I'm going to do one case right now, can be very complicated because they can depend very nonlinearly on the geometry of the domain. So these stresses are typically geometry dependent stresses. They may depend on the curvature. They may depend upon derivatives of the curvature, depending on what physical effect or forces you're trying to capture. And so in this case, the surface stress, and this, what is for surface tension forces, is something which is proportional to the curvature of the surface, which is itself a nonlinear function of the surface position. It involves a high number of derivatives, two in particular. And so from the point of view of a numerical analyst, what this actually means is that this boundary condition can bring in a large number of derivatives of variables, spatial derivatives of variables. So you can have terms, high-order spatial terms, that make problems very stiff. You have time stability constraints that are very difficult to satisfy. And so you have to figure out how to take care of that. And it turns out there's some beautiful tricks that you can do that exploit the fact that these are, in fact, geometry-dependent forces. So you can move into formulations of the problem that naturally respect kind of the differential geometry that's associated with the forces. Okay, and so then I just want to give you another example of what surface tension can do, and I'll talk a bit about a related problem to this tomorrow. So not only are the forces complicated that come with the surface stress, but they can also drive systems into singularities. They can be intimately related to how the system behaves. And so here is a very, in the fluid mechanics community, a very well-known example of an incipient flow singularity. And what you're seeing here is just from a faucet, a droplet of fluid, it's glycerin, that's going through a more viscous and lighter oil. And we all know that drops detach, and this is a very, very slow experiment, so you can watch things in excruciating detail. And what you're seeing happen is the neck that attaches the faucet, the fluid that's still in the faucet, to this pendant drop is getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And that dynamics is actually being driven by the component of the surface tension that's acting azimuthally to this little neck of fluid. And so what's happening is the width, as we know, is going to zero in a finite time. If you describe this by the Navier-Stokes equations and you do some very simple analytical arguments, you will find that that pinching of the neck, which is the same as a topology change, also implies the gradients of the flow velocity must be diverging in that region as I approach that time. And so this comes from Sid Nagel's lab at the University of Chicago. They've been working on this problem for the past decade or so. All right. Any questions? So I'll just continue with my blunderbuss approach. You'll see all of free boundary problems in an hour. Then we get down to brass tacks. All right. So another very interesting area in which there's been a lot of work, especially of late in free boundary problems, is in what are called non-Newtonian flows. And non-Newtonian flows are very important to understanding many industrial processes, and display device design being one, or if you want to understand the dynamics of shampoos, you have to start worrying about non-Newtonian flows. And people who make shampoos do worry about this because they have to figure out how to fill a bottle in an efficient way. So what's a non-Newtonian flow? Well, I won't define it for you quite yet, but I'll tell you what are non-Newtonian materials. Liquid crystalline materials. For example, that could be a liquid where the molecules are very rod-like, and they can have spatial correlations in their orientation. They like to be aligned with one another. So they can have, for example, boundary condition-driven or flow-driven anisotropy, because all these guys are liking to be lined up, and they're also being moved around by the flow. You can have solutions of polymers. So, for example, long stringy molecules in some sort of solvent. Shampoos are like this. Crude oil is like this. And they can have very interesting mechanical properties as fluids. You can also have suspensions. So you can have just regular fluids like water, for example, and suspended in this water is, say, droplets of another fluid, or it could be rods, small wood fibers, things like this, very small objects, and these can dramatically change the way that material as a bulk fluid behaves in all sorts of very interesting ways. And so, for example, you can get very rubbery fluids. They can vibrate. They can have oscillatory timescales associated with them. And so elastic responses. You can have fluids that the harder you drive them, the easier it is to drive them, because as you drive them, you drive down their viscosity, oddly enough. They can have flow-dependent viscosities. This is called shear thinning. You can also have shear thickening. So fluids get harder and harder to push the more you try to push them. Those are not things that you'll see with water, for example, or glycerin, or the kind of common household things you might pour down your throat. So what happens if you put one of these into a Healy Shaw cell? And this is work of Peter Palfis, a longtime collaborator of mine, sitting in the back row. So what I'm showing you here is the same experiment where I have a thin gap, a Healy Shaw cell, and I'm pumping air, but now into a liquid crystalline fluid, not into glycerin, not into water, but into one of these fluids where I have lots of rod-like molecules in it. If the temperature is high, then that material will be in an isotropic state. There's not going to become an orientational correlation between the molecules' position. And it behaves very much like that last one, which was that last picture you saw, which was so extreme, you won't know that this is what it looked like at early times. All right? It behaves more or less like that Newtonian fluid. On the other hand, if you turn the temperature down and it goes through a phase transition and becomes more ordered, then in the so-called pneumatic phase, then you start seeing things like snowflakes come out of it. Very discrete, well-formed tips that persist and don't split. So here you had these fingers that would propagate out, and the tips of the fingers continuously split and grow and split and grow. That is suppressed in the case where I've put it into this pneumatic phase. And that seems to be very intimately related to the fact that one of the bulk properties of liquid crystals in this particular geometry is that they shear thin. So if I push them hard someplace, they're going to have a smaller viscosity than some other place where I don't push them so hard. And so these rapidly propagating tips are associated with smaller viscosities, we believe. And that's work I've been doing with Peter in the past few years. Now, basically, the experimental photographs are, I just write to all of my friends and say, send me your favorite picture. And of course, all my friends happen to be people that work in free boundary problems. So I have a very limited life. All right. So this is another experiment, which is a retake of the classical problem I talked about in the first minutes of this lecture, which was just the rising of a bubble through a fluid. But now, it's not water, the fluid. Now the fluid is something that's called a micellar solution. Now, basically, there's a substructure to the fluid, which is just a bunch of very soft elastic tubes that come from a bunch of molecules self-assembling themselves into what are called bilayer tubes. And when you bend these tubes, they have an elastic response. And they're also, they're very soft. They're continuously kind of breaking and reforming and so forth. And they make this a very complicated fluid out here. And so this friend of mine, Andrew Belmonte at Penn State, he set up a very elegant experiment where he made an annular drum. Well, drums are always annular, but an annular ring of fluid, all right, cased in plexiglass. And he put it on an axle, and he rotated this thing. Actually rotated it this way, because right here in front, there's a bubble that's rising up through the fluid. He rotates it at just the right rate to keep it in a fixed frame. So you can just sit here and stare at this thing forever. Just let it keep rising. Now, in a regular fluid, if you're at low enough or thick enough fluid in the outside, this is a quite viscous fluid out here. If you're in a regular fluid, you just get a nice steady rise of this bubble. This guy does something very different. What you find in this, I should say it's a very elastic fluid. What you find, for example, is that the shape of this bubble is constantly changing. So instead of just rising majestically, it's constantly
boom, boom, boom.
Bouncing up and down. If you look at it, it's just jerking all the time. And what's thought to be happening is that in the wake of this bubble, there's elastic stress that's being stored in these long, stringy objects. And they're periodically releasing that elastic stress. It builds up, it gets released. All these micellar tubes are breaking up suddenly. And so it's constantly, apparently, putting stress into the fluid. It's being released. The thing jumps up. It builds up again. It jumps up. And what I'm showing you in this particular case is what happens when a little bubble just happened to be in the neighborhood. And it's entrained in the wake of this bubble. So you can see what may be happening in the flow in the neighborhood of this trailing edge. And what's happening is that at some time when it starts to bound back up, it shoots this little bubble down like a bullet. Okay, which is some indication that you're actually storing quite a bit of energy into the wake of this object as it's rising. This is, any guess as to what's going on here is really just a guess. The other interesting thing about these types of elastic fluids is that typically, if you can see this in a bottle of shampoo, if you look at a bubble rising in a bottle of shampoo, you'll find that the bottom of the bubble, instead of being rounded or maybe it's a cusp sometimes, what you see is it actually has a knife edge. So it comes down to a nice straight line, just like that. And as this thing is going, that's very typical, and as this bubble is oscillating, this knife edge seems to be coming down, forming a cusp, releasing the energy, forming another knife edge, tightening down, forming a cusp. And so there's lots of interesting things going on here. And what the free boundary problem is doing is it's letting you somehow probe what may be the kind of the constituent properties of the fluid, because this is something you can visualize. You can see what's going on here by looking at the free boundary move. So the game with these types of problems are the following. In Newtonian fluids, which are these kind of common fluids, water, alcohol, like I said, the things you pour down your throat, silicon oil, glycerin. The stress tensor is given by a diagonal piece, a pressure piece, plus a term which is linear in the so-called rate of strain of the fluid. There's a linear relation between the stress produced and the rate of strain in the fluid, the gradients of the velocity. And that works very well with the prescription of what the viscosity is. That works as a very adequate description of many, many fluids that we deal with all the time. In Newtonian, non-Newtonian problems, the real question is, what is this stress tensor? What is the stress that's created in the bulk fluid by having all these little objects in it moving around? Okay, so if I take a droplet of this that contains many thousands or millions of these little objects, what is the behavior of this droplet so far as the stresses that develop within it if I deform it in some way? And so that comes down to saying, what might be this object here? What might be its time derivative? Things like that. And so free boundary problems, people use these to try to probe what are the possibilities for this type of prescriptive modeling. All right. Now, I'm not going to say too much about this right now, but I just want to show you the picture. This is another one of Peter's pictures, something upon which I've done a lot of work on trying to model because it's relevant to all sorts of problems in polymer fluid mechanics. But this is another type of pattern-forming system where instead of a boundary that's separating two fluids or the boundary of a fluid, this is actually some sort of tube in the fluid that's moving around. And its dynamics, it's moving the fluid's moving it, and as a consequence, whatever this object is, which I'll spend in a couple of lectures sometime describing it, forms these very beautiful labyrinthine patterns. And so this is really another material science problem, which has a fluid mechanical aspect. It comes from a phase transition problem. And what's especially interesting about this is that you have to learn how to deal with elastic forces. This is basically kind of like an elastic tube in the fluid, and you have to figure out how to deal with elastic forces that sit on very thin objects and exert forces onto itself across the intervening fluid. And so those are the types of problems that actually arise when you're trying to model the microstructure the microstructural dynamics, if you like, of these kind of polymeric fluid mechanics problems, where now you're actually trying to get down and dirty and model what's going on with little pieces of the microstructure that are evolving. All right, so now, in the last 15 minutes, let me just introduce what's going to be the topic of my last two lectures. So the next lecture is going to be about flow singularities that have to do with the fact of surface tension in fluids. The one after that will be these types of material science / fluid mechanics pattern forming systems. But the last two are going to be something which you'll probably have a much better kind of intuitive feel for. And that's what I call inertial free boundaries in flows. And that's, if you like, that's me and you. All right, we're big, heavy objects, and we're moving through the fluid, and the fluid's interacting with us. We have our own inertia that we exert on the fluid. It exerts it on us. And so there are problems when the inertia of the object in the flow is very important. And so flags, fish, insects, chains bouncing around, all these kinds of things. They're very interesting, and they're very little studied as yet, actually, in the way in which kind of inertial objects really interact with fluid flows. And so in this case, this surface stress, if I imagine that now I'm going to give myself a coordination of this interface, say x is a function of arc length and time, then this surface stress could be a functional of the acceleration of the interface, so inertial forces. It could be a function of internal stresses of a mechanical object, like rigidity or internal tension. So if I take this tube, this isn't a very good one because it actually compresses, but if I take a little piece where it's not folded in itself and I push, I can't compress it, right? And the reason I can't compress it is because it's inextensible, develops a tension which resists that compression that I'm trying to exert on it. So that's an internal mechanical force that can actually be imparted back into a fluid. There could also be external forces like gravity and so forth. And so here, the surface stress reflects much more than just the geometry of the situation. It's reflecting much more the current dynamical state. And so here's the granddaddy, if you like, of an inertial free boundary problem. Which is just a bouncing chain. And here, you really aren't talking about the fluids at all in the exterior of this chain. You're just talking about what is the dynamics of this linked mechanical object. And so these are actually from experiments with this friend of mine, again, Andrew Belmonte. Turns out that understanding the pattern-forming dynamics of a bouncing chain is something that has never really been fully done. And so this is from a physical review letter of this year of ours. And all you're seeing here is what happens when you take a piece of bathtub chain, if you like, and you put it on a little oscillator that just bounces it up and down, and you change the amplitude and frequency of that bouncing so you move it in and out of resonant tongues of instability. All right? And you look at not just the linear instability of that object, but rather the development of its fully nonlinear dynamics. And so you have what we would call pendular states, where it's just bouncing up and swinging back and forth, very chaotic states. You can have what we call stellate states, where it's kind of a rotational precession, bouncing around like this, and you're seeing it from below, and you're seeing it from the side. So you can have all sorts of very interesting dynamics in this simple system. The reason I started to look at this was I was working on the dynamics of flags. Flags are a very interesting problem. Why does a flag flap? And I wanted to understand what happened to a mass-bearing object if there were no fluid on the outside. So it turned out it's a completely classical problem, which was just not ever adequately explored. Now, but if you put a fluid on the outside, let's say you make it a very thin fluid. In fact, it's a running soap film. And my chain, which is now a silk thread, is suspended in that fluid. Then you can try to understand how the inertia of that object in the fluid makes a chain flap. All right? And so these are experiments in the Courant wet lab. And the center of the experimental activity is an assistant professor of ours that we share between math and physics named Jun Zong. And this is joint work with Liebscheber, Childress, and myself, showing what happens when you suspend a deformable object that has a non-negligible self-inertia, if you like, relative to that of the fluid, when you suspend it into a fluid. And what you find, for example, is that you can have bistability, where this thing just, let me describe this a little bit. Well, I'll describe it in a few lectures, but what you're really seeing here is a visualization of the vorticity, or the swirliness of the fluid that's being shed off of this object as the fluid is flowing around it. And what you find is that when the inertia of this object is great enough, it can start to just spontaneously flap. The straight case becomes unstable. There's no oscillation up here now. You're just letting it hang. And so you can actually identify an instability that's associated with the balance of inertia of the object to the inertia of the flow. So I'll talk about that. Why do flags flap? You can do other fun and games in soap films. So you're just taking a picture of what's going on in a very thin film of fluid flowing down between two pieces of fishing line. And there's an object, a compliant object, wedded into that film. Does that make sense? You may not understand exactly what these patterns are, but that's the experiment. Okay? And so you can play other games in soap films, for example, like what are the dynamics of flow in a compliant channel? So now I'm going to put two of these strings very close to each other and just conceive of them as something like a flexible tube through which a fluid is flowing. And you can find different states of behavior where these two pieces of pipe, if you like, are moving together, like the fin of a fish. Or other cases where it's behaving in a more pulsatile way, where it's slamming together and releasing a big blob of fluid at each period. And there it is in the slamming together and then the furthest apart points. And you can try to understand in these simple situations what are the flow effects and their interaction with the compliant boundary that create the dynamics. And then the last thing that I'll talk about is just some very recent work. It's a beautiful problem that we've been looking at in the wet lab, which is actually originally inspired by problems in biology. Actually, the problem of the flag is very much related to problems in biology with swimming and things like this. But this is what happens when you take that flag, you make it a lot stiffer, and you turn it transverse to the flow, and you let the flow bend it. Okay? The relevant problem, not completely directly relevant, but what inspired this originally was the fact that if you look at a leaf of a tree in the wind, and there's a strong wind, it's just not sitting there, you know, presenting its surface area to the wind and incurring a lot of drag. It lines itself up with the wind, and more than that, it curls up. So the flexibility of the leaf lets it reduce the total drag on the tree by deforming and reducing its cross-sectional area. And this is an experimental version related to that, where I have a flexible plate, and I want to ask, how does the drag get reduced by the fact that I can, as I turn up the velocity, this thing becomes more and more streamlined? All right? And this is an experiment studying that. And we have a beautiful theory for how the exponent of drag with the oncoming flow velocity gets reduced by the flexibility of the object itself. And that's what I'll talk about in the last lecture. And so that's a combination of an experiment, simulation, and analysis. So, okay, so that's that. And I hope most of you show up tomorrow. Got me. Well, I mean, the kinds of things that you don't want to happen are those that, for example, will put a lot of bubbles into the fluid when you're filling it up. So you want to avoid, there's something called, this is my interpretation, and somebody who really does this may disagree with me, but when you're extruding, for example, these kind of elastic or shear thinning fluids through an orifice, you can create instabilities on the surface that are called shark skin, and they can be quite violent. And so one thing that you always want to control in kind of extrusion processes or filling problems is surface instabilities. You can have jets moving around. You can entrain air into the fluid. So you want to understand where those occur and where they don't, for example. So that's one thing that people try to control. Well, that's a very interesting question. My preference has been somewhere in between, actually. And so the types of methods that I'll talk about are, in some sense, Eulerian, in that I'll talk about some simulations where the bulk fluid is described in an Eulerian frame, but the surface itself is described in a Lagrangian frame, where you have a local Lagrangian description that tracks around with the surface. More than that, what you find, for example, if you're in certain types of free boundary problems, if you put yourself into a completely Lagrangian frame, most people probably don't know what Eulerian Lagrangian means, so let me just say what this means. So a Lagrangian frame is where I describe the dynamics in the frame moving with the fluid. So I let the coordinate system be the coordinate system that's determined by the motion of the fluid. An Eulerian frame is that you saw when I wrote down the Navier-Stokes equations, where I have a fixed spatial position, and I'm looking at how things change as they move past this position. That's Eulerian. And this choice between whether one describes things in the Lagrangian or the Eulerian frame is a fundamental decision you have to make in describing these problems in the first place. And the Lagrangian frame has lots of natural aspects, right? I mean, you are tracking objects moving through the fluid. And lots of the simulation methods that I come up with are fundamentally between Lagrangian and Eulerian, in that they're tracking the interface, but on the interface itself, they're not moving in the Lagrangian frame. They're, say, keeping the arc length as the frame, or the scaled arc length. And that's to avoid certain stiffness problems that I was alluding to. If you're in the Lagrangian frame, you find the computational points can approach each other exponentially fast, and that causes lots of difficulties. Let me tell you what, there's been very little done on the full Navier-Stokes, and let me tell you why. If you're going to be doing the full Navier-Stokes, then an important part of the dynamics of this problem are that you have a fluid region. So here now I'm showing you a cut through the cell. All right? You have the bulk fluid here. You have a meniscus region here. And you have a very thin film here. All three of these regions are very important in determining the dynamics of the flow. All right? And so the calculations that have been done, so now imagine you take this and you bring it out of the board and you're wrapping this around this whole very complicated interface. That's a very complicated three-dimensional domain that you're trying to describe. That has not been done. What's been done is to look at very specific cases of relevant two-dimensional flows, because mostly the interest is in trying to discover how accurate certain boundary conditions are, but is to look at things like the propagation of a gas bubble into a flow like this, so a cross-section, if you like. And so there are comparisons, for example, of Darcy's law, a simple front propagation, with something like this, where you're describing the bulk fluid in the interface, but not the full pattern-forming system.
So how does the Darcy-Law compare to that?
So Well, that's again a very... I'll show you how they compare. You'll see that in a couple of lectures. It's mostly qualitative. They reproduce a lot of the qualitative features of the experiment. As I said, there are rather detailed calculations comparing calculations like this with Darcy law calculations. And what they show is that you can do an asymptotics to derive boundary conditions for the Darcy's law that gives a rather accurate description of this propagation. And then you have to appeal to the fact that the transverse flow is very long wave compared with this particular flow. So this is like a section of each of them.